horses. That winter, he was placed in charge of another major campaign, the Powder River Expedition against the Northern Cheyennes and their chief, Dull Knife, a group that had taken part in the destruction of Custer's troops. In heavy snow and sub-zero conditions, Mackenzie, with 818 soldiers and 363 Indian scouts, attacked Dull Knife's village at dawn on November 25, 1876. They routed the Indians, killing 25 and wounding many more, and capturing 500 horses, with the loss of only 6 of his own. In April, Dull Knife, hearing Mackenzie was still after him, surrendered. "You are the one I was afraid of when you came here last summer," he told Mackenzie. 2 weeks later, Crazy Horse and 889 Sioux surrendered to Mackenzie at the Red Cloud Agency, ending the Sioux and Cheyenne War. The surrender stands as a sort of bookend to the twinned fates of Custer and Mackenzie, the one destined for eternal fame and glory, the other for obscurity and oblivion. Mackenzie became Sherman and Sheridan's favorite commander in the West, as he had become Grant's favorite young officer in the Civil War. He was the one they sent to deal with difficult situations. In 1877, he was called to the border to subdue bandits. In 1879 and 1881, he went to deal with rebellious Utes in Colorado, issuing an ultimatum to them that resembled the one the Comanches had received at Fort Sill, with equivalent success. He crushed an uprising of Apaches in New Mexico, and was so successful in dealing with the Indians in general that the governor and citizens of the state lobbied for his promotion to brigadier general. With former President Grant's enthusiastic help, he got the promotion in October 1881. But by that time, something was already terribly wrong with Ranald Slidell Mackenzie. Soon after his promotion, he wrote a letter to his superiors with the odd request for reassignment to a military court or retiring board. The handwriting in the letter was so poor as to suggest that the writer had suffered a stroke. He wanted the soft duty, said the tough-as-nails Mackenzie, because he had suffered much harder in the last 2 years than anyone has any idea of. It was the first hint of the calamitous changes that were taking place inside his head. He was nevertheless assigned to the command of the Department of Texas, based in San Antonio. There, at the age of 43, he began a rapid decline. Though he had forsworn alcohol throughout his career, he now began, unaccountably, to drink heavily. His eccentricities, notably his impatience and irritability, increased noticeably. For the first time anyone knew of, he began to keep the company of a lady, the 34-year-old Florida Sharp, with whom he had fallen in love in the late 1860s while on court-martial duty. She had then been married to the base's doctor. On December 9, 1882, the Army surgeon began treating Mackenzie for unusual behavior. On December 10th, the quartermaster said that he thought Mackenzie was insane. A week later, General Mackenzie became engaged to Mrs. Sharp, and it became known that he had purchased property in the nearby town of Burney and had plans to retire there. On December 18th, he drank too much and got into a fight with two local citizens. They had no idea who he was, so they beat him senseless and tied him to a cart, where he was found the next day. Several days later, he was loaded onto a train under the pretext that Sheridan had something important to speak with him about in Washington. On December 29th, he was checked into the Bloomingdale Asylum in New York City. On March 5th, an Army retiring board declared, over his protests, that he was insane and therefore not fit for duty. The rest of his life was a steady descent into madness. He remained in the asylum until June, still protesting his forced retirement, when he went to live with his sister at his boyhood home in Morristown, New Jersey. He had plans to revisit Texas and his property in Burney, but he never moved again. Mrs. Sharp never spoke of him. His physical and mental health deteriorated. He grew more and more childish until he could no longer make himself understood. He died in a New York hospital on January 18, 1889, at the age of 48. What caused Mackenzie's madness? There are several theories. For many years, it was thought that his condition was the result of syphilis, but this is unlikely. The Army knew all about syphilis, dealt with it constantly, and there is no record of Mackenzie ever being treated for it. One historian suggested that his illness was the result of post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition that was unknown at the time. Mackenzie's horrific wounds and central role in many Civil War battles certainly could have produced it, and his irritability, explosive temper, and difficulty forming close relationships are common symptoms. He had also suffered an odd accident back in 1875. In the autumn of that year, he somehow fell off a cart at Fort Sill and injured his head so badly that he was in a stupor for 3 days. It is said that he became unusually irritable in the days that followed. Finally, there is the more remote possibility that the sunstroke he had suffered as a child had something to do with it. We will never know. His death went virtually unnoticed. Quanah, who was 40 at the time, making his way in the new civilized West that Mackenzie had made possible, must have heard about it, though there is no record of his reaction. The day after Mackenzie's death, the following death notice appeared on the obituary page of the New York Times. Mackenzie, at New Brighton, Staten Island, on the 19th of January, Brigadier General Ranald Slidell Mackenzie, United States Army, in the 48th year of his age. In its brevity and lack of detail, the item suggested a minor military figure, perhaps someone who had won a medal or two in the war and had then been put out to grass in some lonely outpost of the new empire. There was no news item in the Times or any other newspapers with the particulars of his life. The event would have seemed to have no more significance to the casual reader than the passing of a manager in a local dry goods company. 21. This was a man. In 1889, the U.S. Congress came up with a new and ingenious plan to steal land from the Indians. A 3-man panel known as the Jerome Commission was appointed and charged with the task of negotiating with the tribes west of the 96th meridian. Their goal was to secure the cession to the United States of all of their title. The idea was simple. The Indians would give up their collective tribal lands. In exchange, each Indian would be allotted a private parcel of land that would be subject to the normal laws of private property. Commissioner David Jerome told the Indians that, instead of a reservation they no longer needed, now you have the opportunity to sell to the Great Father all that land that you cannot use for homes for his white children. The plan had teeth because of the so-called Dawes Act, passed in 1887, which allowed the president, whenever he pleases, to require the Indians to give up their reservations for individual allotments. In council at Fort Sill in 1892, the officials smiled and made nice and did not expect much opposition from Indians who undoubtedly could not comprehend either the idea that they would own private property or the sheer magnitude of the proposed transaction, which would affect some 20 tribes and 15 million acres. They had not counted on Quanah Parker. He demanded that he be told the specifics of the proposed deal. "I want to know how much will be paid for 1 acre, what the terms will be, and when it will be paid," he insisted. Jerome tried to stall, assuring Quanah that he would get his answers by and by. But Quanah would not be put off. "When will you answer the questions?" he asked. Jerome again refused to answer, and Quanah continued to badger him, explaining that, unlike some other Indians who just wanted some quick cash in their pockets, "I want a thorough understanding. I just want to talk about business. Talk to the point." The next day, he pressed even harder. First, he dueled with the commissioners about the size of the allotments. He reminded them that the Treaty of Medicine Lodge had specified 320 acres per person instead of the 160 acres they were offering. And he wanted to know how much the government was going to pay for the land that was left over after the Indians each got their 160 acres. Pressed now, Commissioner Warren Sayre somewhat sheepishly offered up a number, $2 million. The following exchange took place in council. Quanah: "How much per acre?" Sayer, I cannot tell you. Quanah,
how do you arrive at the number of $1,000,000 if you do not know?
Sayer, we just guess at it.
Quanah, we would like to know how much per acre, because we have heard that some tribes received $1.25 per acre, and the Wichitas received 50 cents per acre, and were dissatisfied.
Quanah soon prevailed. The following day, an exasperated Chairman Jerome, acknowledging that yesterday Mr. Parker pushed Judge Sayer hard to tell him how much for 1 acre, actually provided a figure. He now estimated that the government was offering a little over $1 an acre. When they insisted that the low valuation was partly due to the fact that much of the surplus land was rocky and mountainous, Quanah countered,
I have noticed that coal is burned in such localities, and that iron, silver, and gold are found in such places.
Later, he added, the mountains are all supposed to be rocks, and the rocks are supposed to be worthless, but the military use them to make houses with. Thus it went, Quanah hectoring them every step of the way. He was unlike any of the other Indian leaders, who tended to be long-winded, delivering rambling, occasionally poetic complaints that did not address significant issues. But there was no forestalling the government's plan. The Dawes Act meant that the white man could seize the land by fiat, making the new law a mere formality. In October, the Indians signed the Jerome Agreement, which, once ratified, meant that they would get 160 acres of land apiece and would sell what was left over to the government for $2 million. Quanah's role in the final agreement is not known. He signed it, even though it was not in his interest to do so. He stood to lose more from it than any other Comanche, most notably his 44,000-acre rent-free pasture, from which he made $1,000 a year. Quanah also understood the futility of blind resistance. Having nominally agreed to the terms of the Jerome Agreement, he spent the next 8 years, the time it took the Senate to ratify it, lobbying hard for changes in its terms. He pushed for a new deal in which the Indians got to keep all of their land. He eventually championed the setting aside of an additional 480,000 acres. With help from powerful supporters in the East, the Jerome Agreement was eventually modified to include this. The largest chunk of it, 400,000 acres, came to be known as the Big Pasture and was leased to the white cattlemen. The agreement became law in 1900. Another 13 months passed before the reservation was opened. On the eve of the change, some 50,000 Sooners flooded into the country, scouting their own properties and ignoring Indian property lines. Soldiers from Fort Sill cleared the intruders from the land, but they always came back. They stole the Indians' livestock and camped on Indian property. Thus began the Comanches' new lives as owners of property, something they had never wanted and had never really understood. 10 years later, the system had become drearily familiar. Most Comanches leased out their allotments to white ranchers and farmers and simply lived on the lease payments, supplementing them with the $100 or so each received in interest on tribal funds from the eventual sale of the big pasture, and with periodic work picking cotton or harvesting grain. They retained enough land for a house and garden. Few owned any cattle. Most kept a horse or two. By Comanche standards, it was an aimless, purposeless existence. The division of the old Indian lands took away most of Quanah's income. He would never again earn anything near what he made in the 1890s. His unstinting generosity, in fact, would soon make him relatively poor. But this changed very little in his life. His penury coincided with the peak of his power, influence, and celebrity. The busy and complex scene continued unabated at his house, where he shared his food and his lodging with ever greater numbers of people. His celebrity now attracted people who simply showed up at his house wanting to meet the famous war chief and share his legendary table. But mostly the people who came were local Indians. According to his adopted white son, Knox Beale, who later became the translator at the Fort Sill Agency, my father fed a great many Indians. He had a great herd of cattle and horses in 1890, and when he died in 1911, he did not have many left, because he was so generous. When a person became hungry, he fed them. He could not stand to see any one of his tribe go hungry. Robert Thomas, a storekeeper in Cache who knew Quanah well, offers a similar account. By 1910, owing to his generosity and kind-heartedness, he was a very poor man. A great deal of his own food supplies were given away to his tribe, and there were always hundreds of Comanches camped around his home. He was always kind, never speaking ill of anyone. And this man who once rode free on the high and windy plains had also lived long enough to witness the astonishing technological advances of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He found it all fascinating. He wanted to try everything. He had one of the first residential telephones in Oklahoma. He bought a car, an old ambulance for which he was ribbed by his friends who called it a dead wagon, and which was apparently driven sometimes by his bodyguard, a deaf and dumb Comanche named George Washington, whom everyone called Dummy. He had a railroad named after him, the Quanah, Acme, and Pacific Railroad, which itself derived from the West Texas town of Quanah, and often rode in the locomotive, blowing the whistle and ringing the bell. He traveled frequently and liked staying in hotels in big cities, with their gas lights and modern conveniences. On one of his many trips to Fort Worth, a gas light nearly killed him. He was sharing a hotel room with his father-in-law, Yellow Bear. Before retiring, Yellow Bear blew out the gas light before going to bed, a mistake Indians often made. Before the night was over, he was dead of asphyxiation, and Quanah, who remained unconscious for 2 days, barely survived. The events of the year 1908, when he turned 60, suggested the distance civilization had traveled since his birth on the prairie. That year, Teddy Roosevelt sent his magnificent white fleet of steel gunships around the world, and Henry Ford introduced the mass-production automobile known as the Model T. That year, Quanah himself appeared in the first two-reel Western movie ever made, The Bank Robbery, filmed near his home in Cache, Oklahoma. He had a bit part. There is something more than a bit surreal, more than 100 years later, about watching Quanah himself emerge from a stagecoach, pigtails falling down over his shoulders, or ride toward the camera. At this distance, there is simply no reconciling it with the idea of free and wild Comanches on the Llano Estacado. Quanah also had a curious and noteworthy friendship with Teddy Roosevelt. In March 1905, he rode in an open car in Roosevelt's inaugural parade in buckskins and war bonnet, accompanied by Geronimo, two Sioux chiefs, and a Blackfoot chief. One of the people who witnessed that event was Robert G. Carter, the officer who had been ambushed by Quanah at Blanco Canyon and who still hated Quanah bitterly and did not understand why someone who had killed so many whites could march in such a parade. The two men met at a party Roosevelt hosted for the chiefs. A month later, Roosevelt traveled west on a special train to participate in a much-publicized wolf hunt on lands belonging to the Comanches, Apaches, and Kiowas in southwestern Oklahoma. His principal hosts were leading cattlemen Burke Burnett and Daniel Wagoner and the Comanche chief Quanah Parker. This wasn't just fun and recreation. The 400,000-acre big pasture where the hunt took place was one of the most hotly contested pieces of land in the West. By virtue of the revised Jerome Agreement, the Indians held title to it and leased it to the likes of Burnett and Wagoner. But a large group of land-hungry whites, supported by Texas Congressman James H. Stevens, wanted the government to buy the land and open it for development. When Roosevelt's train arrived at Frederick, Oklahoma, he was met by a crowd of 3,000 and then escorted by a mounted honor guard, which included Quanah, to a speaker's stand in the middle of town. Quanah said later that he had been afraid someone might try to shoot the president. McKinley had been assassinated 4 years earlier and thus had worn a six-shooter for the occasion. The idea is unimaginable today. Roosevelt made a few brief remarks, then invited Quanah, whom he called a good citizen, to come up on the stand with him. The two men shook hands to rousing applause, and then Quanah gave a short speech. There is no record of what he said, but he later told his friend R.B. Thomas that, "I got more cheers than Teddy." Roosevelt clearly liked and admired him. "There was Quanah Parker, the Comanche chief," he wrote in his description of the wolf hunt, which had bagged 17 wolves and coyotes, in his book Outdoor Pastimes of the American Hunter, "in his youth a bitter foe of the whites, now painfully teaching his people to travel the white man's stony road." After the wolf hunt, Roosevelt traveled north to visit Quanah at Star House, a truly momentous occasion in tiny Cache, Oklahoma, for which all conceivable pomp and circumstance were brought to bear. Quanah made a point of serving wine, which he never drank, in large goblets, specifically because at the White House, Roosevelt had served the Indians wine in small goblets. In his typical fashion, Quanah used the occasion to lobby Roosevelt on Indian issues. The main one was the disposition of the 400,000 acres. Quanah wanted the Indians to retain it. He eventually lost the battle. 2 years later, the land was divvied up and sold off, with Comanche children born after 1900 receiving 160-acre parcels. Proceeds went into an Indian trust. Quanah also complained of territorial officers trying to collect taxes from Indians and of the Indians' terrible unemployment problem. Evidence that Roosevelt listened came in a letter he wrote a few days later to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. "My sympathies have been much excited, and I have been aroused by what I have seen here, and I am concerned at the condition of these Indians and seeming hopelessness of their future." The wolf hunt and his visit to Quanah are often cited as reasons Roosevelt became determined to create the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge, which today is just north of Quanah's old home. Quanah remained an active leader, even into his old age. Unhappy with the Indian schools and finding that his children were unwelcome in the white ones, he put on his broad-brimmed Stetson and wool suit and went lobbying for a new school district. He donated the land, promised that his tribesmen would pay taxes, and got it done. In June 1908, he became head of the school board in the district he had started. He became one of the leading religious figures in the Comanche tribe and the driving force behind the establishment of the peyote religion among the Plains Indians. Peyote is a small, spineless cactus whose ingestion produces visual and auditory hallucinations. It had been used by Comanches as early as the mid-19th century, and the Indians of South Texas had used it as early as 1716. Quanah revived its use and refined it into a meaningful religious ritual that Indians embraced during the grim early days on the reservation. He would preside over all-night rituals, many of which were concerned with the healing of specific people. From his Comanches, it spread to Kiowas, Wichitas, Pawnees, and Shawnees before the turn of the century. Between 1900 and 1907, it was adopted by the Poncas, Kickapoos, and Kansas, and subsequently spread throughout the plains and into the Great Basin and deserts of the Southwest. Wrote Wallace and Hobel, "It was probably the most important cultural contribution of Comanches to the lives of other American Indians." Quanah, who came under fire from time to time for his involvement in these rituals, once defended his religion by saying, "The white man goes into his church and talks about Jesus, but the Indian goes into his teepee and talks to Jesus." The practice eventually evolved into the entity that became known as the Native American Church. In spite of his success and his eventual triumph over his rivals, Quanah's life was never easy. He had to fight to keep prosecutors away from his peyote cult. As he got older, he had marital troubles. Several of his wives ended up leaving him, perhaps because of his growing financial problems. And he struggled constantly with political rivals in the tribe, including the old medicine quack Isatai, who never gave up in his quest to become the principal chief of the Comanches, and the Kiowa Lone Wolf, with whom he once had a fistfight over a boundary dispute. Charges made by Lone Wolf's Kiowa faction, aligned with Isatai, in fact, led to a federal investigation of the agency in 1903. The federal agent who investigated, one Francis E. Lupp, not only concluded that Quanah and the agent had done nothing wrong, he had this to say about Quanah: "If ever nature stamped a man with the seal of headship, she did it in his case. Quanah might have been a leader and a governor in any circle where fate might have cast him, It is in his blood. His acceptability to all but an inconsiderable minority of his people is plain to any observer, and even those who are restive under his rule recognize its supremacy. He has his followers under wonderful control, but on the other hand, looks out for them like a father. The contrast could not be greater with his more famous neighbor, Geronimo, who had been relocated to Fort Sill from Alabama in 1894. Unlike Quanah, he attracted no crowds and few visitors. Though he was a genius at self-advertising and made a lot of money selling his signatures, bows and arrows and such, he reportedly died with $10,000 in his bank account, he was not well-liked in Indian country. Hugh Scott, an officer at Fort Sill and a great friend to Indians, described him as an unlovely character, a cross-grained, mean, selfish old curmudgeon. He drank and liked to gamble, and died from injuries he received from falling off his horse while drunk. The two men's legacies stand very much in contrast, even in death. Geronimo is buried in the Apache Cemetery in Fort Sill, whose address happens to be 437 Quanah Road. 22. Resting here until day breaks. Quanah never forgot his mother. He kept the photograph Sol Ross gave him, the one taken in 1862 at A.E. Corning's studio in Fort Worth with Prairie Flower nursing at her breast, on the wall above his bed. She had been taken from him when he was only 12. In a matter of minutes, she had disappeared forever into the white man's world. He later learned that she had been unhappy and that she had repeatedly tried to escape to find him. Like her son, she had adapted brilliantly to an alien culture, but she could not do it twice. In 1908, he placed ads in Texas newspapers seeking help in finding her grave. He got a response from a man named J.R. O'Quinn, his first cousin and the son of Cynthia Ann's younger sister Orlena, who told him he knew where to find it. It was Quanah's first contact with his Texas family. Later, he heard from another cousin who invited him to a family function in Athens, Texas, southeast of Dallas. He would eventually be embraced and celebrated by his Texas family. Having found his mother, he now lobbied for money to move her grave from Texas to Oklahoma. Persistent and persuasive as always, he convinced his congressman to sponsor a bill authorizing $1,000 to relocate Cynthia Ann's bones. The bill became law in March 1909. He traveled to Texas, met some of his white family, and found the cemetery where she lay. On December 10, 1910, she was reinterred at the Post Oak Mission in Cache. At a ceremony over her grave, Quanah gave a simple speech in his fractured English. 40 years ago, my mother died, he said. She captured by Comanches, 9 years old. Love Indian and wildlife so well, no one to go back to white folks. All same people anyway, God say. I love my mother. He himself had less than 3 months to live. He had been busy in the fall of 1910, as usual, traveling to Dallas in October for a celebration known as Quanah Route Day at the Texas State Fair. Its purpose was to promote the Quanah, Acme, and Pacific Railroad, which ran through the town of Quanah, Texas, just south of the old reservation. Quanah, who rarely turned down a chance to appear in public, drew an overflow crowd. According to a Dallas Morning News story from October 25, 1910, the SRO sign was hung out yesterday afternoon at the convention hall. Every seat was taken, and standing room was at a premium. Chief Quanah Parker of the Comanches was, of course, the principal attraction. He was there with his 12-year-old son, Gussie. Both were dressed in war bonnets, buckskins, and moccasins. He spoke in a voice that was clear and resonant and distinct to those even in the rear of the hall, although his words were occasionally broken and difficult to understand. "Ladies and gentlemen," he began, "I used to be a bad man. Now I am a citizen of the United States. I pay taxes same as you people do. We are the same people now." He spoke of his mother, of stealing Mackenzie's horses at Blanco Canyon. He told the audience about his trips to Washington to work for my Indians and about meeting Roosevelt. He was funny and engaging, telling stories he had told many times before. He, of course, did not mention his career as a raider and killer of white people. In the best American fashion, he had carefully removed the less savory parts from his past. He took the time to deny, once and for all, that his father, Peter Nakona, had died in the Battle of Peace River. He was lying, but he had a clear and forgivable purpose. He was trying to save his father's reputation. Then he concluded with an odd remark.
"Just one more minute. Here is one more say. My ways call for money every time they send me to the fair. Two men came to me about a year ago to go to New York City. I give you $5,000 for 2 or 6 months to take your family over there. I say, no, you put me in little pen. I no monkey. That is all, gentlemen."
Then, as the paper noted, as the throng crowded forward, he took each person by the hand and pressed it, and frequently his face was wreathed in smiles. His last comments were, perhaps, a way of saying that he, unlike, say, Geronimo, had limits on how far he would exploit his fame and his heritage. Dignity, he was saying, had its limits. Why he was moved to point that out will remain forever a mystery. As far as we know, they were his last public words. In February 1911, Quanah was returning by train from a visit to some of his Cheyenne friends, reportedly to seek a cure at a peyote meeting. He knew he was sick. Traveling with his number one wife, the childless Tonarsi, he rode the train with his head bowed and his lips trembling. When he arrived home in Cache, he was taken to his house by his white son-in-law, Emmett Cox. He died there on February 23rd of rheumatism-induced heart failure. Word of his death moved like electricity through Oklahoma and Texas in both white and Indian communities. By morning, hundreds had gathered at Quanah's house, with its double porch and bright red roof marked with large white stars. By noon, the crowd had swelled to 2,000. Mourners came on horseback and muleback and in farm wagons and buggies and automobiles. There were whites wearing Sunday clothes and Indians in buckskin and blankets. They moved in a long, slow procession to the church, where only a small fraction of them could fit. Those outside sang and prayed. Eventually, they all filed past the casket where Quanah lay adorned in his favorite buckskin, his trademark plaited hair falling over his shoulders. At the gravesite, mourners sang, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and then the casket, draped with brilliantly colored blankets, was lowered into the grave beside Cynthia Ann's. When his family sorted through his estate, they found that there was not much there. He had a few hundred dollars in the bank. His wife, Tonarsi, who was recognized as his widow under Oklahoma law, took the rights to one-third of his land allotment. Wife Tope, who had 2 children, aged 2 and 11, got the house. His eldest son, White Parker, got the cherished and now famous photograph of Cynthia Ann that had hung over Quanah's bed. Otherwise, there were a couple of horses and mules, a coach, a hack, and a buggy. He did not have much else. He owed $350, a debt that was covered by the sale of his mules. That was all that remained of the last chief of the Comanches. Except for his house, he had what amounted to a nomad's possessions, a sort of symmetry that some Comanches might have appreciated. 4 months after his death, the Secretary of the Interior ordered the Indian superintendent to eliminate the office of chief and instead to create a committee formed of members of the tribes. In later years, there were chairmen, but no paraibos. The lords of the South Plains, meanwhile, were fast fading into America. That was what Aboriginal cultures did, if they did not vanish altogether. It would be inaccurate to say that the Comanche adapted well, or that Quanah was a model that the tribe as a whole was prepared or equipped to follow. The first generations of Comanches in captivity never really understood the concept of wealth, of private property. The central truth of their lives was the past, the dimming memory of the wild, ecstatic freedom of the plains, of the days when Comanche warriors in black buffalo headdresses rode unchallenged from Kansas to northern Mexico, of a world without property or boundaries. What Quanah had that the rest of his tribe in the later years did not was that most American of human traits, boundless optimism. Quanah never looked back, an astonishing feat of will for someone who had lived in such untrammeled freedom on the open plains and who had endured such a shattering transformation. In hard times, he looked resolutely forward toward something better. That sentiment appears obliquely on his gravestone, which reads, "Resting here until day breaks and shadows fall and darkness disappears is Quanah Parker, the last chief of the Comanches." His school-educated daughter probably wrote it, based loosely on a verse in the Song of Solomon, a book of the Old Testament that settlers, among them his forefathers, carried with them into the lethal West, where Stone Age pagans on horseback once ruled the immemorial land. Quanah would have been pleased. This concludes Empire of the Summer Moon. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.